Today is November 30th, 2016, and we are here at United Orthodox Synagogues for our weekly Lunch and Learn. And we are recording this as well as we are live on Facebook. So hopefully we'll have some people joining us that way as well. Today we have some really fascinating material that we are going to be studying. We're going to be looking at an episode in this week's Parsha, but we're really using that episode as a way to address a bigger question, which is the question of how should we go about viewing the shortcomings of the biblical characters, mistakes, failures, questionable things that they did. Is it okay to question them? Can we look for the roots of some of their mistakes? Those are some of the questions we're going to be dealing with. So this week we have Parshat Toldot, and we begin on page 48 in the Chumash. I see that my father's watching on Facebook, so I'll say hi, Dad.
Oh.
See?
But there's only Abraham.
No, so now we're already up to Yitzchak.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay? Because in last week's Parsha, Abraham sent his servant Eliezer to find a spouse for his son Yitzchak, and they now at the beginning of this parsha we read of the birth of Yaakov and Esav. Okay, so let's just look at it very quickly. Page 48. Ve'ela toldot Yitzchak ben Avraham. Avraham olid et Yitzchak. Vayi Yitzchak ben Avraham shana b'kachtor tivka bat betuel amari. Right. So now we're just catching up. We're recapitulating last week. Yitzchak gets married, and Vayatar Yitzchak l'Hashem l'nuch l'shoki akarahi. Yitzchak prays to Hashem because his wife was unable to bear a child. Vayatar lo Hashem v'taharifka ishto. God responded to his plea, and she's pregnant. And we know, lo and behold, there are twins, and Yaakov and Esav are born. Okay, that's just a very quick Reader's Digest version of the beginning of the parsha. And then we come to the question at hand. We turn to page 49, and we're going to look at Pasuk Chaf Zayin, verse 27. Vayigdalu hane'arim, vayihi Esav ish yodeat sayed ish sadeh, v'yakov ish tam yoshev ohalim. When the boys grew up, Esav became a skillful hunter, a man of the outdoors, but Yaakov was a mild man who stayed in the camp. Vayahav Yitzchak et Esav kitzayed befiv Rivka ohevet et Yaakov. Isaac favored Esav because he had a taste for game, and Rivka loved Yaakov. So what the commentaries struggle with here is trying to understand why this recognition of the difference in character between Yaakov and Esav only is apparent once they grew up, right? Vayigdalu hane'arim. They grew up, and now we realize that there's a difference between them. Now it seems that Yaakov, that Yitzchak and Rivka finally realize that there's a difference between Yaakov and Esav. What took them so long to finally realize this? And that's a question that the commentaries deal with. And in fact, there's a midrash that sort of gets right to this question. This is a midrash in the packet that you have in Midrash Rabbah, Bereshit, number 63, in the section 63, paragraph number 10 in the midrash. And the boys grew, right? That's the pasuk that we have. Vayigdalu hane'arim. All right, Pinchas, page 1. Turn it over, Shula. No. Oh. No, other, turn it over. There. That's it. You have it. Right here. On the right side of the page, and the boys grew. Rabbi Pinchas said, in Rabbi Levi's name, they were like a myrtle and a wild rose bush growing side by side. When they attained to maturity, one yielded its fragrance, and the other its thorns. Right, so Yaakov is obviously the fragrance, right, and Esav the thorns. So for 13 years, both went to school and came home from school. After this age, one went to the house of study and the other to idolatrous shrines. So they, up until a certain amount of time, they were just going about their childhood business. They went to the same school. They came home. They were young, so they did everything that they were supposed to do. But when they grew up, it's only when their differences became apparent. The next part of the Midrash is really interesting. Rabbi Eliezer ben Shimon said, a man is responsible for his son until the age of 13. Thereafter he must say, right, Baruch Shepetarani Meyoncho Shalazeh. That's the bracha that is said at a bar and bat mitzvah. I think that second half of the Midrash is very interesting. I think it may be a way, it's a little bit of an apologetic, meaning up until that point, Yitzchak and Rivka did what they were supposed to do. And now that the boys are growing up and they're going on their own different way, and Esav is turning out to be not such a savory character, well, you can't blame Yitzchak and Rivka for that, because they're only responsible for them up to 13. Once they become 13, they wash their hands of responsibility. We're going to see that not everyone is as kind as this Midrash. Right? This Midrash seems to be saying, okay, it's fine. Yitzchak and Rivka did what they were supposed to do. They sent them to school. And then when they were done at school age and they were left to their own devices, they went on their own separate ways, and Esav sort of went off the derech, as they say. And then the Midrash says, but we can't blame Yitzchak and Rivka, because after a certain age, it's no longer the parents' responsibility. Yeah.
Right at the beginning of the first verse, it says, Rivka conceived, and the children struggled in her womb. And so right away, God said to her, they're going to be two nations, they're going to be two different people. Why are they surprised?
Well, it doesn't say that they're
yeah, two nations
it doesn't
are in
say
your
that
womb.
They're surprised, meaning the sense is, why does the text only sort of hint to their different personalities only once they grow up, right?
Because here they're telling me when she was pregnant that they were.
Why does the text only allude to it once they grow up? Okay, so like
something's wrong here, because it says, "Blessed he who has now freed me from the responsibility of his boy." What is it really saying there? I mean, does it say that I don't want anything more to do with him, or what?
Good question. It means, and you probably said this bracha at your son's bar mitzvah. What it means is that when a child becomes bar mitzvah, hopefully they've had proper education in their home as to what their responsibilities are, and now they are responsible for their own actions. If they sin or do something wrong, right? In America, we have a big problem with this. In Judaism, once you're 12 for a girl or 13 for a boy, you're an adult. Now, we have in America, it's very hard to think of our 13-year-olds and our 12-year-olds as adults, because we still treat them very much like children, and we don't necessarily give them as much responsibility as we should, or as much freedom maybe as they could handle. But at 12 or 13, they take responsibility for their own actions. Again, that's presuming that we've given them proper education and proper training and proper understanding of what their responsibilities and what their burdens are in life. So it doesn't mean that you don't care about them. It doesn't mean you don't try to help them. But from a spiritual perspective, and you could even I would even think from just a general perspective, it's time that they take responsibility for their own actions. That's what this means. Okay.
Also, that they, before them, when they are young, they don't take so seriously certain behavior pattern or thing like that. But at certain point, they think, well, it's childish. But certain point is they give up because they see that it's already molded, that it's more, it's sort of like fixed. It's beyond. They cannot.
There comes a certain point where you can't change children's behavior no matter how much you try anyway. That's true, too.
But that goes against the concept that you can always do tshuva, right? I mean, you can always.
Yeah, you can always do tshuva. Right, you. But there comes a point where a parent's ability to really influence wanes and becomes less and less, and that as the child becomes older. Yeah, of course, every individual has the ability to change themselves and to listen to what other people are saying, but at 13, it's their responsibility. Okay, so this Midrash is what some people say led Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch to make the following comments on page 2. Right, because the Midrash is telling us that they did everything they were supposed to do. They sent them to school, and when they became older, they did their own thing. And so here, Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch is trying to understand, again, what happened to Yaakov and Esav. So it's true, let's assume, that that Yitzchak and Rivka did everything they were supposed to do and gave them both a very solid education, etc. Right? Why is it that that Esav acted differently? So this is a famous analysis by Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch on page 2. Our sages, who never objected to draw attention to the small and great mistakes and weaknesses in the history of our great forefathers, and thereby make them just the more instructive for us, we'll get back to this later, here too on Vayigdilu make a remark which is indeed a signpost for all of us. Right? This is the, now he's referring to the Midrash. They point out that the striking contrast in the grandchildren of Abraham may have been due not so much to a difference in their temperaments as to mistakes in the way they were brought up.
Sure, blame the parents.
As long as they were little, no attention was paid to the slumbering differences in their natures. Both had exactly the same teaching and educational treatment, and the great law of education, Chanoch Lenar al pi darko, bring up each child in accordance with its own way, was forgotten. That each child must be treated differently with an eye to the slumbering tendencies of his nature, and out of them be educated to develop his special characteristics for the one pure human and Jewish life. The great Jewish task in life is basically simple, one and the same for all. But in its realization, it is as complicated and varied as human natures and tendencies are varied. So here, Rav Hirsch is saying something really amazing. He's saying, yes, it's true that that Yitzchak and Rivka gave Esav and Yaakov the same education. But that was the problem. Right? They shouldn't have given them the same education. They shouldn't have treated them differently. They should have realized that Yaakov had one temperament and Esav had another temperament. And had they realized that, maybe they would have educated them differently, which would have led Esav, right, to better choices in life. If we continue, this is really nice what Rav Hirsch says. He says now that serving God is not the same for every person. Right? The definition of what it means to serve God is going to be different for different people. When Father Jacob visualized the tribes of our nation in the sons standing around his deathbed, right? Fast forward to the end of the book of Genesis, he saw not only future priests and teachers, he saw around him the tribes of the Levites, the tribes of royalty, of merchants, of farmers, of soldiers. Before his mental eye, he saw the nation in all its most manifold characteristics and diverse paths, and he blessed all of them. And ish kivirchato beirachotam, each according to his specialty, with and in his different path of life did he bless them. For the covenant which God established with Abraham wants to win a whole national life, a whole fresh, complete life of a nation with its manifold classes and occupations, all for the one and same great task of lishmor derech Hashem lasot tzedakah mishpat. Their strength and courage, no less than brain and lofty thought and fine feelings, are to have their representative before God. Meaning, there are lots of ways to serve God and the nation. You could be a farmer, right? You could be a soldier. You could be a scholar. And you could just add to the list, as long as you're all doing it to make God's name great and to do righteousness and justice. But just because of that, must each one be brought up, al pi darko, Rav Hirsch continues, according to the presumed path of life to which his tendencies lead, each one differently to the one great goal. Rabbi Lichtenstein wrote about this when he wrote about what thoughts people should have when they think about what profession to go into. Right? Choosing a profession is an opportunity, lishmor derech Hashem, lasot tzedakah u'mishpat, to protect the way of God and to do righteousness and justice in lots of different ways. So find a profession that you're good at that allows you to do the most good in the world, right? As opposed to find the profession that allows you to make the most money, right? There has to be other that not ein kemach ein Torah, right? It's not that as Jews we say you're supposed to live a life of poverty and take a vow of poverty, but right, we have to realize there are lots of ways we can serve God, and when we think about what we're going to do with our life, we have to ask that question as well. So he says Yaakov was perfect to be to serve God in the Beit Midrash and with his mind. Esav had a different temperament. Maybe he would have served God as a soldier. Maybe he could have served God in some other way. But Yitzhak and Rivka missed it. And since they missed it, they gave them both the same education, assuming they were all going to end up being scholars. And that's why Esav ended up off the derech, as they say. Right? Turn to page 3, and here Hirsch says it explicitly. Had Isaac and Rebecca studied Esav's nature and character early enough and asked themselves, how can all the strength and energy, agility and courage that lies slumbering in this child be won over to be used in the service of God? And the future Gever, man, be trained to be not a Gibor Tzayed, but a hunter, but in truth a Gibor Lefnei Hashem, a brave or a great man before God, then Jacob and Esav, with their totally different natures, could still have remained twin brothers in spirit and life. Quite early in life, Esav's sword and Yaakov's spirit could have worked hand in hand, and who can say what a different aspect the whole history of the ages might have presented. Right, I mean, this is really here. Hirsch is going off in grand language, right? The whole history of the world could have been changed. Right? It's really a lot of blame he's putting on poor Yitzchak and Rivka. Right, the whole history of the world could have been changed had they not blown it. Especially if you accept the rabbinic view that Esav represents Rome, right, and all of the terrible things they did to the Jewish people because Esav went off the derech. Had Yitzchak and Rivka done it differently, you know, who knows how Jewish history or world history would have turned out? Differently. Notwithstanding that very maybe hyperbolic language at the end of that point, the educational point is very easy to understand for anyone who has children, right? That they're all different and they all need to be looked at and viewed differently. This is also a very, very, very good piece to use from a perspective of Zionism, right? You build a country. And you build a land, and there are all ways to serve God, right? Through draining the swamps, and or now being we don't drain swamps anymore in Israel. Now they build and high tech and all the business opportunities, right? Those are also ways to serve God by building a stronger Medinat Yisrael, and we shouldn't take those for granted. And not every kid is going to sit in the Beit Midrash, and not everyone is going to do this. And you have to.
And we need plumbers,
right?
Too.
And you have to. But the point is, the education. The education has to be that, right? Sometimes the message our kids get is find a job that's going to help you earn the most money. The message should be find the job that's going to give you the opportunity to support your family, to give tzedakah, to do righteousness and goodness. Right, and within the framework of serving Hashem. Yes,
perhaps Shula. There is a suggestion that there is criticizing the parents, their preferences. First of all, the parents have a conflict in their attitude toward the children, and then also, for a mother, it stated that she loved more the
right.
other one.
Right.
And
okay, so hold
so
that
they,
thought.
They make it more
great.
Obvious the difference.
Good point.
Them.
So hold
they
that thought. We'll get to the Netziv in a few minutes. Why his explanation of why Yitzhak and Rivka couldn't get their act together. You're 100% right. There seems to be some miscommunication between Yitzhak and Rivka. Yitzhak liked Esav. Rivka liked Yaakov. And there's no recorded conversation about Rivka saying, hey, he's a bum. Yaakov's the guy. Or let's fix Esav this way, right? There's no and so we're going to, you make a very, very good point. We're going to get there in a few minutes. Yeah.
Well, I mean, how would you compare what, or utilize what Shimshon and Paul Hirsch is saying here to the predecessors, right? To Abraham with Ishmael and Yitzhak?
Maybe you can make the same.
Would it be different just because we're not as...
Although I'm not...
Because they didn't really come, they didn't have the same mother?
Well, it could be that. It also could be that there's no clear indication... I think it's much clearer here, these texts, that Esav was going off the path as opposed to Yishmael. Yeah, it's a fair point.
With the, you know, the mother with Sarah saying, you know, get him out of here.
Right.
I like Yitzhak.
Right.
And Avram saying, wait, what about this guy?
Right, that's a good point. Okay, now I want to look at this amazing text by Zalman Sarutzkin in his commentary called Aznayim LeTorah, because he raises a fascinating question. This is on page 4. The Midrash are full of terrible things that Esav did. Now, it could be that these are the rabbis working backwards, right? Once Esav is not the chosen one, we have to figure out, we have to backload why. And, oh, why? Because he did this, and he did that, and he did that. But none of that's in the Torah.
It's a prequel.
Right? None of it's in the Torah. So let's read it, starting on the bottom of the right column, where it says, Chaf Zayin v'yidilu ha-narin. This is an amazing comment. Kol zman shehayu ketanim lo hayu nikarim b'maaseihem. This is Rashi. Right? While they were little, their differences were not apparent. Kevan shenasu b'nei yud gimel shana ze pirash lebate midrashot v'ze pirash la'avodat elilim. When they became 13, one of them, Yaakov, went to the Beit Midrash, and Esav went to worship foreign gods. Again, that's not in the Torah. Okay? Ne'manim aleinu divrei chazal she'asu Esav kol hata'avot asher sana Hashem. Right? We have all the testimony from the rabbis in the Midrashim that Esav did everything that God hates. Aval nifla hadavar shelo ne'mar mizeh mufurash b'Torah. But isn't it amazing that these terrible things that Esav did are not in the Torah? Rak masha macharat habichorah v'ratzah laharog et Yaakov. All we have is that he sold the birthright and wanted to kill Yaakov. Now, if he's wanted to kill Yaakov, we could justify, because Yaakov tricked him out of the bracha, right? In fact, some commentaries say, even Chazal say, that Yaakov, when he was tricked later with Rachel and Leah, that was midah keneged midah. Yeah. That was measure for measure for tricking his brother. So if Chazal could say that about Yaakov, then we certainly could understand why his own brother is going to be upset, right? So madua kasta haTorah kisita haTorah al masav hamichorim. Why does the Torah hide these terrible things that Esav did? So answer, v'nir eh shebazel lamda Torah zechut al Yitzchak. The Torah, hiding it, is trying to give Yitzchak the benefit of the doubt. Shahavet bino harasha. Right? How could it be that Yitzchak loved Esav, who was a rasha? V'ratzalim sor lo et habrachot, and wanted to give him the blessings. V'hainu mipnei shelo yada mimasav harayim. The Torah hides them to remind us that they were even hidden from Yitzchak, shel Esav, yoter mimashen emam refurash b'Torah. There was more, but it was hidden. So then, what's the question? The next question has to be, and that's what Zalman Sarutzkin asks: how could Yitzchak have missed it? If he was going to Avodah Zarah and doing all the things that God hates, it's a lot of things God hates. How could Yitzchak have missed it? So listen to what Zalman Sarutzkin says: mipnei shelo hishkiach acharav v'lo badak kedibai. He just wasn't paying attention to him like a father should.
Most fathers don't.
Okay. Ooh. Oh. Wow. Okay. Kedibai mama asav. He wasn't paying attention to his actions. Umizeh. So this is, by the way, interesting. So now we have Rav Hirsch and Rav Zalman Sarutzkin both patching Yitzchak a little bit. Rav Hirsch blames the mother and the father. Here, Rav Zalman Sarutzkin just blames the father. It's the father's job, he says, to make sure his son is on the right spiritual path. And how could you be blind to that? Umizev Sharlul Mod. But now Rav Zalman Sarutzkin does this. I'm not just criticizing Yitzchak for the sake of criticizing Yitzchak. I'm criticizing Yitzchak to teach you, dear reader, what the parent's responsibility is. Umizev shalul mod et darkei achinuch. From this mistake, we can learn the proper way of chinuch. She'al ha'av l'zchor tamid she'haben ha'shovav darko l'hastir et masav. kids are always trying to hide their bad, their misdeeds from their parents. You need 7 eyes to watch your kids. You have to even pay attention to the small deviations, because if you let those small deviations go, they're going to turn into big deviations. Now, I don't want to get into the question of whether Rav Zalman Sarutzkin's parenting policy is appropriate for 2016, and just, you know, and how much we have to impose our will or not. That's not the point. The point is, he's also taking Yitzchak to task and realizing that Yitzchak made a mistake by not properly supervising his son. And he goes to list 3 separate aspects of Esav's life that if Yitzchak was paying better attention to, he would have figured it out. Number 1 is the Avodah Zarah. Right, how could you not realize that your kid is going off to worship a foreign god? Right, that's number 1. If you turn the page to page number 5, number 2 is, this is great. What does this mean that he was, page 5, Sayed Befiv, right, that Esav was a hunter. So what did Yitzchak say? Yitzchak said, if he's a hunter, he's going to go out, he's going to make a little parnassa, right? It's okay if he's not going to the Beit Midrash. He's going to go out and hunt, and he's going to go sell his food. And he's going to make money for the family. That's okay. But that's not what happened. He didn't do it. He just sat around. Right? Look at the top of page 2. V'hinei beveito shel Yitzchak haya ma le'echol. V'asu v'esav haya tzad tzayed v'ochel b'kinuach su'udah. K'zolalei basar. Lo limkor v'litzpor kesef li'yom ra. He wasn't doing it to sell food and then keep, you know, hold on money to build a rainy day fund. Im Kane Einzo Umanut. This wasn't the son going off to earn a living, which would have been perfectly okay. This was a ruse, a fake. And finally, the Gam Devar Kazetzarach Ebedika Me'ulab Masav. This also he should have noticed. And finally, V'Hastia HaShlishit, where it says number 3, Shara Yitzchak Be'esav, Hishalakach Lo Nashim Mirishaot, V'Hein Lo Yadu Kimoto L'Ramot Etezakein. Right, he realized that they were no good. Yitzchak realized that they were no good, the wives, because they weren't able to fool him. But how come he didn't say anything? But Tiena Marat Ruach Yitzchak Shirash Ein Mikatrot LaAvodah Zarah. He saw that they were doing Avodah Zarah, but he felt, no, that's just them, not my son. So he was totally blind to his son's Avodah Zarah, to the bad wives that they took, to the fact that he really wasn't working for a living. He was a freeloader, right? All those things he wasn't paying attention to. And had he paid better attention to, maybe he would have, quote unquote, helped him make better choices. Make better choices. So here we have Rav Zalman Sarutzkin in a very pointed, right, almost merciless 2-page attack, right, on Yitzchak for not properly supervising. Again, but it's not that he doesn't have awe for Yitzchak, but they're humans, they make mistakes, and the Torah records the mistakes for a purpose. Why does the Torah record the mistakes? So we can learn from them. Like Rav Zalman Sarutzkin says, you should learn from Yitzchak's mistake. You need to pay attention to your kids. We'll flip ahead just for a minute before we get back to the point I was making regarding Shula. On page 7, where the bracket is, so the Torah is no collection of examples of saints. It relates what occurred not because it was exemplary, but because it did occur. The Torah never hides from us the faults, errors, and weakness of our great men. Just by that, it gives the stamp of veracity to what it relates. But in truth, by knowledge which is given us of their faults and weaknesses, our great men are no wise made lesser, but actually greater and more instructive. If they stood before us as the purest models of perfection, we should attribute them as having a different nature, which has been denied to us. Were they without passion, without internal struggles, their virtues would seem to us the outcome of some higher nature, hardly a merit and certainly no model that we could hope to emulate, right? If we viewed the forefathers and foremothers as perfect, then we would feel no ability to emulate them or to be like them, because they're perfect, but we're not. But they were So Hirsch is saying, this is why the Torah records these mistakes. So we could realize that despite their humanity and despite their mistakes, they still reach such great heights. Therefore, so can we. And now he gives a beautiful example from Moshe. Take, for example, Moshe's anava, Moshe's humility. Did we not know that he could also fly into a passion? His meekness and modesty would seem to us to be his inborn natural disposition. Right? If we thought that Moshe had no emotion, then who cares if he's humble? That's easy to be humble if you don't care about anything. And lost to us an example. Just as Shimuna HaMorim, but however, at one point Moshe yells at Bnei Yisrael. And he loses his temper. Gives his anava, but that losing his temper gives his humility its true greatness. Shows it to us as a result of a great work of self-control and self-ennoblement, which all should copy because we all could copy. So Moshe got angry, true, but most of the time he kept it together. So the fact that he had in this midah, this negative midah, if you will, of anger, but he managed to hide it and or suppress it and still be called by God as the most humble person, that shows us that we also could achieve that. So that's why the Torah talks about the shortcomings of the imahot and avot. Okay, so now we come back to Shula's point, right? What was going on between Yitzhak and Rivka that they couldn't get their act together, right? It seems that they were giving negative messages about Esav. I will tell you, by the way, that Hirsch and others make a big deal out of this when it comes to the question of Ben Sorer Umoreh, right? The rebellious son. And the Torah says the parents have to deliver to the Beit Din to be stoned. But if you, the Gemara and Rav Hirsch even further unpacks those verses very, very carefully. And one of the things that he derives from that, it says, because the Torah says that the father and mother have to come to the Beit Din, and they both have to say, B'neinu Zeh Ben Sorer, our son is a Ben Sorer Moreh. And from there, the Gemara learns, and Hirsch expands on this, that you could only be a Ben Sorer Moreh if the kid was getting the same message from both parents. If the kid was getting conflicting messages, then what would we expect? Of course we expect the kid to misbehave, because he's not getting a clear definition of what his path should be. So that also relates to this, and Yitzhak and Rivka's inability to give Esav the same message and to understand him in the same way. So this is really so, this is amazing. This is Naftali to Yehuda Berlin in his commentary on last week's Parsha talks about the first time Yitzhak and Rivka meet. Let's just remember what happens. Eliezer, the servant, we say is Eliezer, he has no name in the Torah, goes to get Rivka. He brings her back, she's on a camel, and she's approaching where Yitzchak is. The Torah says she sees a man in the field. We say he's davening. And right away it says vatipal me'al hagamal, which everyone translates as she got off the camel. Naftali to Yehuda Berlin says, what do you mean she fell? She fell off the camel. She was in such awe of this sight of this man that she saw before him. He was very impressive, whatever he was doing in the field, that she freaked out and she fell off the camel. And then what happens next? Then the Torah says, and she covered herself in a veil. Okay? Now let's pick up the Netziv.
That's what it says in the text.
In the text. Covered herself in a veil. Let's pick up the Netziv's commentary. What?
I thought she was on the camel.
And then she fell. And she fell off the camel. She fell off the camel, and then she covered herself. Look on page 6.
What was it, the burqa or veil?
I don't know. A burqa, a veil. Page 6. This is such an amazing and gutsy comment by the Netziv. Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. Ready? Yeah. You see the bracket, bottom section on the right side? Batikach HaTzaif, right? She took the veil and she covered herself. Mirov Pachad Ubusha. She was afraid and embarrassed in front of Yitzchak. Kimo she mivina she'ena ri'uya lihiyot lo le'isha. As if she felt unworthy of being his wife. Umeaz vehala. Here's the point. And from that moment on, nikba b'liba pachad. She was always afraid. V'lo haita, listen to this, V'lo hayta im Yitzchak kimo Sarah im Avraham v'Rachel im Yaakov. She did not interact with Yitzchak the way Sarah interacted with Avraham and the way Rachel with Yaakov. Asher, what does he mean? B'hiyot lehem ezek kipeda alehem. When Sarah or Rachel had any complaint against their husband, lo boshu l'daber retet lifnehem. They were not embarrassed to speak angrily, powerfully before their husband. Masha ein kein Rivka, which is not the case with Rivka. V'chol ze hakdama lahasipur. This is all by ways of an introduction to our story. Sheyavo b'parsha Toldot.
Yeah.
Right? That's going to happen in Toldot this week. Shehayu Yitzchak v'Rivka mechulakim b'deot. They, Yitzchak and Rivka, had different opinions on their son. Umikomakom. Lo matza Rivka lev lahamidet Yitzchak al data. Rivka did not have the guts, because she was always afraid of him. She never felt herself worthy, so she could never muster up the courage to say to Yitzchak, "You're wrong about Esav." Right? Right. Mikol makom lo matza Rivka lev lahamid et Yitzchak al data b'divarim nichochim ki hi yodat haemet. She knew the truth, but she couldn't bring herself to tell the truth. Ki Esav raktzai b'fiv. She knew that he was fooling everyone. Now. V'chein b'shat ha-brachot. The same thing with the brachot. V'chozeh. Now.
With a nerve to...
Right. And so instead of speaking directly to Yitzchak, she has to go through this whole subterfuge to trick him into giving Yaakov the bracha. Right. That is the classic example of dysfunction.
Right?
Menitziv has discovered the first dysfunctional family in history.
So right? I mean, it's terrible.
Now, it is the Nitziv. It is the Nitziv who then says this was all set up by Hashem in order to get Yitzchak, in order to get Yaakov the brachot. But still, the psychological and marital insight is ingenious, right? That if you have a one spouse who feels that they can't speak their mind to the other spouse, of course there's a great chance that the kids are gonna get messed up because they're not getting clear direction from their parents, and the parents don't have a single message. And so that could explain why they had the same chinuch, because there was never a conversation between Yitzchak and Rivka as Yitzchak raving, or maybe he should go to a different school. Maybe he doesn't belong in yeshiva. Maybe he belongs in a school to become a farmer. And Yaakov will be the Rosh Yeshiva, right? I mean, who knows what the conversation would have been? But that's a really amazing insight so Naftali goes back to that story as a source for the problem that only emerges a couple of chapters later in our story. Now, we don't have time to do it. I did it a few weeks ago in our Shabbat afternoon class, but there's an amazing letter written by Yitzchak Huttner in Pachad Yitzchak, in number 128 in the collection of letters, where he's writing to a student who feels that he's failing. I've failed so many times. It starts on page 8. I must be worthless. And Rav Huttner says, the problem is that when we see our Gedolim, he says he's talking about contemporary or the previous generation's great people, but it directly relates to what we said. He said, when we think of someone like the Chafetz Chaim, who wrote the book on Lashon Hara, we think he was born a perfect being. And we think he never had any desire to speak Lashon Hara, but who knows? Maybe the Chafetz Chaim fought against the urge to speak Lashon Hara every day, and that's why he wrote the book. Mm-hmm. Right? We don't know. So you assume that all these great rabbis that you read about are born the way you read about them. No one's born that way. Everyone struggles. And he quotes a pasuk. I'll just give you this one beautiful pasuk that he quotes. He says on top of page 9, he says, we have a pasuk that says, Sheva yipol tzadik vikam. Right? That tzadik falls 7 times and stands up. He says, you know what that means? It means because of those 7 times, a tzaddik rises up. It's not despite the 7 failures that a tzaddik becomes a tzaddik. It's because a righteous person fails again and again and again that he's able to rise to higher heights. It's really an amazing letter, an amazing act of encouragement from a Rosh Yeshiva to a student. And he says, I know how hard you've tried, and I know how much you've accomplished, and you're doing just fine. Just keep doing what you're doing. And that directly relates to what Rav Hirsch said, right? We have to read about the failures of our great people to realize that they also had struggles and became great. So to understand that we also could become great despite our own struggles. I'll just to point out, there's two Gemarot, lots of them, but two Gemarot in about Hillel, right? One where Hillel, when he becomes the Av Beit Din, is arrogant and haughty, and lacks any sense of anava, any sense of humility. And then there's that the Gemara that I talked about last week in Shul, where these people keep coming back to Hillel on Erev Shabbat to ask him these ridiculous questions just to see if he can get angry. And there it said the Gemara's lesson is we should be as humble as Hillel. So you have to juxtapose those two Gemarot. On the day he became the head of the yeshiva, he was an arrogant, mean-spirited person. And then he became the paragon of humility, right? So you have to learn both of those Gemarot. If you only learn the Gemara about Hillel being humble, you think that he was born that way. But we know he didn't start that way. And the Gemara is not afraid to tell us that Hillel had his shortcomings as well. So this is why. So there's no reason why we should not openly discuss these shortcomings. As long as we're doing it in a way to build our own, build our own character. We're not studying these shortcomings of Yitzchak and Rivka to hurt them. The Torah has them there for a reason, so we should learn from them. Okay, everyone, that's it. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.